This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. President Donald Trump's attacks on the press have been aggressive, from dubbing media outlets fake news to sharing memes of network logos being blown up or attacked. His long-promised fake news awards came out last night. It was a list of media outlets which published inaccurate reports, which were quickly corrected. Of course, none of this has quieted journalists in the U.S. We are protected from the president by the First Amendment, and frankly, good luck making a reporter shut up just because you don't like him. But in more repressive regimes around the world, it is much easier to shut a journalist up or make him disappear. And the term fake news is showing up a lot more often. How much damage is the president's rhetoric causing here and abroad? And how should journalists deal with the growing lack of trust that many Americans have in the press overall? Joining us in studio to discuss it is Tom Rosensteel, the executive director of the American Press Institute. His books include Blur: How to Know What to Believe in the Age of Information Overload. Tom, welcome to 1A.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Also with us in studio is Hugo Gurdon, the editorial director of the Washington Examiner. Hugo, welcome.
Hi.
And joining us from the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, Indira Lakshmanan, the Institute's chair in journalism ethics and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Indira, always glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Joshua.
We're also happy to have your questions and thoughts about trust, or the lack thereof, in the media about this concept of fake news. Who do you trust? Who don't you trust? And why? And for that matter, what would it take to rebuild your trust? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Indira Lakshmanan, let me start with you. These long-promised fake news awards came out last night. They were tweeted out on the Republican Party's official website. Tell us a little more about this list, what's on it, and what it said.
Well, I mean, first, let's give a little backstory to our listeners who may not be, you know, listening and paying attention with bated breath every single moment like reporters are. But Donald Trump first started talking about supposed fake news awards and a fake news trophy last fall. And he even encouraged his supporters to send him suggestions for what they thought was the fakest news of 2017. And he, you know, kept saying that there was going to be, stay tuned for these, there's so much excitement about these fake news awards. I mean, this goes back to Donald Trump's persona as a reality TV star. And he's trying to, I would say, deflect attention away from actual news, actual policies that are taking place, to his war on the media. And he postponed the supposed award at least twice. It finally came out yesterday, not sort of with a red carpet fanfare, but with a tweet, as you say, in which he said, oh, they're finally here, linked to a GOP website that, by the way, crashed because of traffic and had a 404 error for a long time. But what I found so striking about the list was that essentially, as you say, it was either in first place, he had Paul Krugman, who's an opinion columnist. You know, opinion columnists make predictions all the time that don't necessarily come right, but that's not exactly what we would call fake news. And the rest of them were essentially errors that do get made by any news organization and that were, as you say, quickly corrected, and people were even let go because of those errors. But it all was a big drum roll to what he saw as the main event. At the very bottom of his list, he had, you know, he would kind of buried his lead, which is he said, the biggest fake thing of all is the Russia probe, which shows, of course, that he's worried about what the Russia probe might find. And I think the real story here is that Donald Trump is trying to distract attention away from and discredit the independent press because he's worried about, he's scared of us. He's scared of what journalists may report that would be bad about him. And he wants to try to say, that's not true. Don't believe anything you hear.
Tom Rosensteel, I wonder if we need to come to some kind of consensus on this term. Anyone who's listened to this show knows that I hate the term fake news, because if it is fake, by definition, it ain't news. Leaving that aside for a minute, for the purposes of this conversation, what exactly do we mean when we say fake news?
Well, I think the president has appropriated a term that was being used during the election for sites that were not actually news sites and information that was not really news, that was actually fiction. And we now know that some of that, a fair amount of it, was coming from state-sponsored operations coming out of Russia. That's not that, you know, that's not a, up for debate. That's been established. The term was later appropriated by Trump and now by many others to apply to basically news accounts that you didn't like, that were critical of you. It's a clever rhetorical device. The problem, I think, is it's damaging. Trump will be president. A president is a steward of the republic. And what Trump is doing with this rhetoric is he's trying to delegitimize one of the institutions that we that is constitutionally protected and that the founders recognized as a necessary element of democracy. For people to self-govern, they have to have accurate information so they can make decisions and form public opinion. The word public opinion actually was an outgrowth of the Enlightenment. So without a free press, without a press that people trust, it becomes very difficult to have a democracy. What happens after Trump leaves if no one respects the press?
Hugo Gurdon, I think that part of what makes the term fake news so thorny is that it taps into something that I think a lot of people feel, especially now in 2018 with a zillion different news sources and more ways to purvey information, including bad information, than ever. I wonder if you feel that the president has a point in any way, whether this idea about fake news, whether or not he is blaming the right people, whether there is anything underlying that idea that bears serious consideration and isn't just a pure backhanded insult.
Yeah, I think absolutely that it does. The first thing that I think it is worth prefacing all remarks on this with to say that these awards are sort of an embarrassment. They really should never have taken place, that the president should not be attacking the media. He should actually, I think, be to some extent above those attacks, even though, to go to your question, he does have a point about the failures of the media. It seems to me that there's some truth in his assertions. There have not been only mistakes in reporting, but there has, I think, been an undertow, in fact, a very strong undertow, not just of error, but of opposition to this president since before he was even inaugurated. You may remember, possibly as long ago as about 18 months, just Huffington Post, for example, decided not to treat his candidacy as political news, but as entertainment. This was an expression of disdain and contempt for what he was doing.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Hugo, but just to affirm what you're saying, they literally moved coverage of President Trump to the entertainment section of HuffPost.com.
Exactly so. And many news organizations and many journalists openly discussed the extent to which their fears about Donald Trump, their opposition to Donald Trump, should relieve them of the normal duties of objectivity towards the president. And so, as I say, there's been a kind of undertow of hostility and opposition. And I would say that to a great extent, this is due to the fact that so many people got the election flat wrong. There are journalists all over the Capitol and in New York, too, who are paid for their expertise. They earn hundreds of thousands of dollars a year because they're supposedly experts. And there has been a move, I think, even if it isn't necessarily a conscious one, to oppose the president, because otherwise they'd have to say he, for example, he is not a legitimate president. They want to delegitimize him because that means that it's the voters who made a spectacular mistake on election day, not them.
We're speaking to Hugo Gurdon of the Washington Examiner, Tom Rosensteel of the American Press Institute, Indira Lakshmanan of the Boston Globe and the Poynter Institute, and with you about the relationship between the public and the press. We welcome your questions and thoughts. Email us, 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A, as Josh did. Josh tweeted, "I would love to read or watch a news company that makes a concerted effort to give positive and negative stories to both sides of the aisle and to the president." Homie Don't Do That tweeted, "You can defuse Trump by giving us more who, what, where journalism and less analysis and opinion. Activist, partisan journalists have done untold damage and, in my opinion, led us to Trump." It's also interesting how some of you are seeing this phenomenon play out among younger people who have grown up marinated in digital media and are learning how to parse fact from fiction really for the first time, including this listener who left a note in our inbox.
This is Melinda calling from Athens County, Ohio. I'm a high school English teacher, and the current climate in regards to news has really caused me to consider how I interact with students. I have some students who boldly claim, in a tone that's similar to the president, that facts are simply untrue. They were very uncomfortable with an assignment that required them to look at info in an unbiased manner. I've never had students who were so reluctant to differentiate between fact and opinion.
Melinda, I appreciate you calling in. And Tom Rosensteel, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but I wonder if we could begin to deal with this terribly frightening reality that facts do exist, and somehow we got to get back to the place where people know that facts are real. What do we do about that?
Well, this is what we call a wicked problem. There are many causes to this, and it's hard to unpack them. One of them is that the point of fake news as a strategy is not to cause people to believe the fake news. It's to cause them to doubt all the news.
And I do want to get more into that, particularly what our role is as members of the media to improve trust. And also, I got to say, what your role is as a consumer of news and information to be savvy consumers as we get back to our conversation. And we welcome more of your thoughts as well. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing President Trump's attacks on the media and the public's trust, or lack thereof, in the press, with Tom Rosensteel of the American Press Institute, Hugo Gurdon of the Washington Examiner, Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute and the Boston Globe, and with you. Do you trust the press, the media? For that matter, what do we mean when we say the media and who you trust or don't? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A. For that matter, are you seeing anything that any news organizations are doing to regain your trust? Who's doing it right that you think other news organizations should learn from? Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Tom, you wanted to finish your thought, and then we'll keep going.
Yeah, I just in response to something Hugo said, I think that the press's relationship, first of all, the press, of course, is a much more diverse and heterogeneous institution than it used to be. But I think its relationship generally with Trump is more complex than them feeling that they somehow missed the election or misunderstood him. First of all, journalists sort of build on foundations of facts. They're sort of like carpenters in that regard, and they have this fidelity to literal accuracy that everything they think builds off of that. Trump, you know, has a different approach to sort of how people learn and understand things, and he's fast and loose with facts. He also has challenged the press and its as an institution. He's described them as the enemy of the people. He's thrown down this gauntlet, and it becomes a sort of existential challenge. How do you cover someone in an impartial way who has described you as the opposition and the enemy? So he's both infuriated the press, he's raised their game, but he does set a trap where then anything that they say that's critical of them seems to prove his thesis that they are the enemy.
Hugo?
I think that those are very good points. Describing the press as the enemy of the people is something that the president should not do. I would say that, nevertheless, that he does have a strong point about the adversarial approach that the press has taken. The adversarial approach began before he was president, and has in the first 100 days of his presidency, negative stories accounted for 80% of the reporting on Trump. These are much higher numbers than previous presidents. This wasn't because of anything he had done in office. This was the way that the press decided to treat him from the outset. And
well, that's not entirely true. There was that whole thing about the crowd numbers at the inauguration in which Sean Spicer went out and said, this is the largest crowd for any inauguration, period, and
yes,
it stopped off without taking questions.
This was a very silly thing for them to say, and as you say, I mean, President Trump is casually dishonest and misleading. We know that. On the other hand, the press has decided that it is... I shouldn't say perhaps decided. I think that I called it an undertow originally. There is an undertow of opposition. I don't think they wake up every morning saying, how can we get rid of Trump? But I think that they feel that they are the opposition to Trump.
Well, I think there is something, Hugo, definitely to what you're saying, that a number of our listeners are feeling reflected in the press right now. Mark emailed, I voted for President Trump. Don't agree with everything he's done or the way he's conducted himself at times. I am a viewer of both Fox News and CNN as my primary news streams. I used to really enjoy CNN for a different perspective until after the president was elected. So much of the time spent is a hatchet job against the president to the point that I don't want to watch. The obsessive negativity of the reporting seems to highlight the president's accusations against CNN. Dustin emailed, I think there may be a silver lining to the fake news controversy, an increase in the scrutiny by consumers and publishers of the information provided by the media. It is in each party's interest to be increasingly vigilant, lest one consume or distribute a flawed item easily debunked. Glad to hear Dustin's being a savvy news consumer. And Indira Lakshmanan, there's some recent poll data, and I don't want to linger on the poll data too long, but there's a recent poll by Gallup and the Knight Foundation that kind of reifies this idea that the distrust today is deepening, it's different. Can you walk us through those numbers?
Sure. This study came out on Tuesday, and it is the latest in a whole string of studies that have looked at trust in media. And we know Gallup has been looking at trust in institutions since the 1970s. And since then, trust in the media has been dropping since around 1977. And the fact is, so this is not new. This is not a new problem. It's not as if Donald Trump invented distrust of the media. He has profited from it, and he has ridden a wave that has begun, really in the 80s with the rise of talk radio and Fox News in the 90s, which, as Tom Rosenstiel has written about extensively, you know, this came out of the Reagan administration in 1987, essentially abolishing the fairness doctrine and giving way to allowing people to open up sort of unipolar news organizations. And then those news organizations found it in their interest from a revenue point of view to say, don't trust anyone else, only trust us. We're the only ones telling the truth. So it's been decades now of certain institutions saying, don't believe the mainstream media, they're biased. What Donald Trump has done is he has grabbed onto this and really made it almost like a one-trick pony. And it isn't just as president that he has attacked the media. He was doing it in his campaign as well, calling journalists not just enemy of the people, which he did as president, but calling them scum and slime, mocking a reporter who had a disability. In one of his rallies, he was referring to how in other countries they kill reporters. And he said, oh, well, I would never. And, you know, some of his supporters were cheering that on, that idea on. And he said, well, I would never kill them, but I do hate them. And some of them are such lying, disgusting people. So it's easy to set up this straw man of the press. And I think it goes back to the idea of trying to discredit the press because he wants to discredit facts and information. He wants people to believe that he is the only true source. Now, you know, let's put this in the context that according to the Washington Post fact checker, who's been tracking every statement he makes, that since he took office, he's made an average of more than 5 false and misleading statements a day. So more than 2,000 since taking office. And I don't believe he's run corrections on any of those. So, you know, it takes us back to this Knight Foundation poll. What I found really disturbing in the Gallup Knight poll, and there are so many pages of it, there's a lot to look at, but was that 40% of Republicans who were polled said that accurate news stories. So remember, the pollsters are saying if a story is accurate, but it's an accurate news story that casts a politician or a political group in a negative light, they said that should always be considered fake news. That means that the term has become completely completely politicized and totally devoid of meaning. As you say, Joshua, if something's fake, it's not news by definition. I entirely agree with you. And of course, the president appropriated this term that had originally meant hoax stories, like Pope endorses Donald Trump, you know, those kinds of things. And he's turned it on its head to mean anything that is said that is bad about me. Now, I really think the most important point is just that the press should not get politicized in covering the president. There is a way to cover the president straight. If you're a straight news reporter, you should cover the president straight.
Right.
But you also have to stay, you really have to hew to the facts and not allow truth to be completely dead in all this, because the war in the media is really a war on the truth. And all of us, you know, I think our professional obligations are first and foremost to the truth. And that's what we have to be sticking up for every single day.
A number of you are also grappling with the term fake news. Moondog writes on Twitter, fake news exists. Look at InfoWars. Anything with the word patriot or freedom, and to a lesser extent, pick some liberal keywords. You can claim that's not news, but the people who parade the fake news term around believe these to be accurate sources of news. Our public is at its most uninformed. Raymond wrote on our Facebook page, the integrity of the mainstream media has been questioned long before Trump even considered running. The 24-hour news cycle prioritizes ratings over accuracy way too often. Retractions and clarifications rarely occur during prime time. Does he overuse the term? Yes. Does the media stoop to his level of pettiness in response? Unfortunately, yes. I should also note, Indira just mentioned the fact checker for the Washington Post. We did a conversation on this program last year about how fact checking works. What does it take to fact check a news story? You'll find that conversation on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Tom Rosensteel, I kind of like Raymond's comment, and I wonder if maybe that's part of the issue with trust in the media. I mean, every news source doesn't have the same standards. They're not all equally interested in getting it right. Some really are just interested in the ratings. Some really are just interested in keeping you watching for as long as possible. And I'm okay with that as long as I know what I'm getting. Maybe that's part of where the conversation has to go, that we don't think that all journalists come from like the Mount Sinai School of Journalism and we descend through the world in the same way. It's not all the same.
Right. And as Indira pointed out, and I think it's a very important point, half of the decline in trust in the press occurred between 1980 and 1997.
You're talking about through poll data.
Right. That there was a drop of a third in a level of trust. And then there's been another equal drop since then. This is associated with people having more choices. And as there are more news organizations out there, they're competing for people's attention by, discrediting each other. So there's a couple of problems here. One is that as media speeds up, it also becomes less accurate because speed is the enemy of accuracy. There are very few laws of journalism that, you know, apply in all cases, but that is one of them. And another is that you can practice a journalism of what I call affirmation, which is really designed to get people to follow you and buy your product and watch you because you reinforce their prejudices. And really what the next 10 years are going to tell us as media change is how much of a market is there for information that's been carefully verified and the proof has been sort of made very transparent. And it may be that Trump's presidency actually helps this cause because he's articulated a case, a kind of negative case for why people should believe things like the Washington Post and the New York Times.
We asked a number of you which news organizations you trust. Jerry writes Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Matt gives his vote to The Intercept, especially The Intercepted podcast with Jeremy Scahill. It's crucial listening. Becky writes, I listen to NPR constantly, but I feel there is inherent bias. I also follow BBC and Fox to balance my news. I never listen to MSNBC or CNN because the bias is stomach-turning. I wouldn't say it is necessarily fake, but what bothers me is a lack of critical thinking and interpreting facts from a liberal viewpoint without providing a legitimate conservative perspective. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Hugo, I'm not sure how I feel about Becky's comment. Like, on the one hand, I get that she wants to listen to BBC and Fox to balance her news diet. But on the other hand, that's kind of like saying if you fall asleep at the wheel and you swerve to the left, the correct response is to swerve to the right. No, it's not. Get back in a straight lane. Like, it feels like we're picking competing biases and calling that balance. That's wrong.
Yeah, certainly. You don't correct things by swerving off the opposite side of the road. That's certainly true. But the point that Tom and I think Indira made about the proliferation of news sources perhaps means that news organizations or listeners and readers don't really have much choice but to look at several different news sources and try and work out for themselves which are delivering news most accurately. And I think this goes to the point that Indira made about the technology and the profits. News is now the barriers to entry to delivering news, to being online, are so low as to be almost non-existent. Anyone can get on there. It's very, very difficult for news organizations to make a lot of money, and they have reduced things like fact-checking. They're employing people who are, there's such an appetite for news that there are a lot of people in the news business who are not experts in their subjects. And one of these things that this reminded me of was, Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor under President Obama, when he was talking about the Iran deal, said how easy it was to create an echo chamber and to make sure that the administration's view about the Iran deal was disseminated, because reporters were clueless. And because the velocity of news is so high, because the volume of news is so high, because the economy or the economics of news delivery is now so tight and people don't make profit, it's very much easier for what might be called fake news or simply erroneous news to be disseminated, far easier for governments and anybody else to get their viewpoint out there and accepted.
Well, certainly we have a lot more empowered news consumers, including this listener who left a message in our inbox.
My name's Ashton. I'm calling out of Tucson, Arizona. In response to how Trump's comments of fake news has impacted my viewing, it's truly empowered me. When I hear a news story breaking and I catch something on TV, I'm actually more empowered to go online and really dig through the information myself. So in a way, I have to thank him for saying that, because it's empowered me to be my own searcher of information.
That is awesome, Ashton. I think that's very smart. Thank you very much for calling in and sharing that. Tom, I wonder if we could define something that I think comes up a lot for people who are trying to be savvy news consumers. There's been a lot more sources tell us reporting in the era of Donald Trump, which is not, it's not a journalistic sin, but it's one of those things you got to use carefully. I know we're low on time before we have to pause, but there are some terms that get thrown around: on the record, off the record, on background, deep background. Can you give us, for people who see these things in news stories, can you give us a primer on what these things mean and how we should look at them if we see them in a story before we have to pause?
Yes, and even reporters get confused by this. On the record means I can name you. It's just like you said it on tape.
White House Press Secretary Joshua Johnson says.
Correct. On background means I can quote you, but I cannot name you. Off the record means that I cannot use what you said, but I can try and verify it with someone else.
So if I see, a source close to the administration tells NPR News, that was probably something I got on background.
That's background. Or what would, a nuance of that is deep background, which is I can't describe you very carefully, but I, or very specifically, but I can use what. And where the confusion is people think that even reporters will confuse off the record with on background. Off the record means I cannot use that unless I can go somewhere else and get and verify it, substantiate it with a couple of different sources.
So I can run with that as if it's true, but I can't report it until I get it from a source that's either on the record or on background.
Right.
Sue writes on Facebook, I'm tired of people who think the media should be regulated when the Constitution allows for freedom of press and their job is to challenge the people in power as a check. Do the people who dismiss the press as fake want us to go down the path of tyranny, as some foreign leaders have done, by jailing or killing those who report in the opposition? Good point, Sue. And there have even been some American reporters for U.S. news outlets who have run into those kind of regimes firsthand, including the dictatorial regime of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. We will learn from a journalist from the New York Times what that's like up close. Stay close. We'll talk more about so-called fake news in just a moment, but before we do, we'd love your help with some real news about the National Park Service. This week we found out that most of the National Park Service's board resigned. 9 of the 12 members handed in their resignations, led by Alaska's former governor Tony Knowles. Reason being, apparently, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke was unwilling to meet with them. So far, President Trump has not nominated a director for the Park Service. What's going on? If you work for the Interior Department, including the National Park Service, or maybe if you know someone who does, leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. What is going on at the Interior Department and the National Park Service? Now, we understand if you need to remain somewhat anonymous, but do share as much detail as you are able and tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. 1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories soon on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Tom Rosensteel, Hugo Gurdon, and Indira Lakshmanan. Indira, I wonder sometimes if maybe we in the press are being a little too sensitive in the way that we talk about the public's view of us. I mean, we're in the public eye. We got to take a little bit of abuse. Until I read this email from Michael, who wrote on our Facebook page, the most common kind of fake news is the incomplete information story. Example, the court case against Cliven Bundy was thrown out and the judge ruled that the federal government can't try again. If this had gone the other way, the media and 1A would be all over it. But as it is, NPR listeners can expect to hear crickets. By covering up these events and not reporting them, the media are giving the people who listen the fake view that nothing of significance is happening in that respect. So, 1A, you are part of the fake news. Do you get it yet? Here's the problem, Michael. You're wrong. We searched for Cliven Bundy at NPR.org and found 94 results. I Google searched Cliven Bundy site NPR.org on Google. You know what the top result was? Judge dismisses federal case against Cliven Bundy and Sons, bars retrial. It's a report by NPR's Kirk Sigler and Colin Dwyer that aired on January 8th on All Things Considered, the flagship news program on NPR. So I would agree with you, Michael, but I think you need to get your facts straight. And Indira, it's moments like this that make me feel, as a journalist, really ticked. Yes, we bear a lot of responsibility, but what responsibility does the public have to be smart consumers of news and not crucify us before we have a chance to be properly tried?
That is such a great question, Joshua, and I love that, you know, with a few keystrokes of a Google search, you could discover that no, in fact, NPR has thoroughly covered that story and reported on exactly what, you know, the listener said he hadn't seen. What I always find striking is, and you see this on the internet a lot, on Twitter, you see people say, you know, why is the media not covering blah, 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 and then they link to something, which is, of course, a story about whatever it is that they think
from
the media,
a media
is
organization,
not,
right.
Yeah, that they think the media is not covering. But, you know, this was in this Gallup night poll that came out on Tuesday that you're referring to. And one of the most striking results was that 45% of the more than 10,000 people polled said that they felt there was a great deal of political bias in news coverage, which is a significant increase from the same poll back in 1989, when only 25% said the same thing. I think part of the reason for this is because of the rise of opinion journalism. And the problem the sort of weakness, and this is particularly true in television, of distinguishing between what is opinion and what is news. Newspapers are doing a better and better job of this, and I want to give a particular shout out to the Washington Post, which has done a great job both in the paper and especially online of labeling. So you can run your cursor over a story and understand, is this news? Is this analysis? Is this opinion? And with a little description underneath of what that is, what the definition of that kind of a story is. Less so on cable news, where, you know, it is much cheaper to put a bunch of talking heads on screen than it is to send a reporter out into the field, whether it's to a national park or to Syria, and do the hard reporting and the costly work of making a package and editing it and putting it together. So television has relied more and more on talking heads, and it's not clear, I think, to the average viewer that these are opinionators. These are not necessarily news reporters, and often you have news reporters on with opinionators. And this is something where I think the news industry has a responsibility to be more transparent, to do better labeling, to help the public understand better what it is that we do, to explain how we do things. But the public also has a responsibility to educate themselves, like the caller who left the message before the break saying, you know, now that when I hear something is fake, which, by the way, is a word that Donald Trump has used more than 400 times since taking office, according to a count that CNN released yesterday. You know, he's anything he doesn't like, he calls fake news, fake polls, fake stories. Anytime you hear something is fake, do some research yourself. Look at the URL. Check out, is this a legitimate news site? You know, go to the little hamburger where you can navigate on the screen and see about this news organization. Find out whether it's a legitimate organization and whether these are trusted sources.
Tom Rosenstiel, I know we have another voice to add to this conversation, but briefly, I did want to ask you if we could zoom out just a little bit. There are other countries, I mean, the UK among them, where news organizations have always had a slant. There's plenty of newspapers on every side of the political aisle. I wonder how much of a problem this actually is, considering that in other parts of the world, it's fine to have news organizations that don't play or that do play favorites, as long as you just kind of know what you're getting.
Well, these other the places where we see that more partisan tradition typically have parliamentary systems with multiple parties, and there's a publication that represents each party. And there tend to be also smaller countries where the publications are more national. The American media grew up in a different way. It's the only one that's constitutionally protected, and most of our media were local and not connected to national party. We also, I think, as a result, had a better media, a more rigorous, more accurate, and more highly trusted media than these other countries did.
Erica tweeted, I visited Cuba and bought an English language paper this summer, and one can begin to appreciate a free press when they see how differently information is portrayed. Yet this is also why I look to other countries for more varied news through BBC and Al Jazeera. Peacebird tweeted, Trump is attempting to discredit the Fourth Estate and our government intelligence agencies. These are moves used in the past by fascist dictators. I think now is a good time for us to bring in a reporter who has dealt or is dealing with a repressive regime firsthand. Joining us now on the line is Nicholas Casey. He's the Andes Bureau Chief for the New York Times, based in Medellin, Colombia. Nicholas, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you used to be based in Venezuela, but have been banned from entering that country. You've told that story somewhat before, but could you briefly bring us up to speed? What happened in Venezuela?
Sure, I'd be happy to tell it again. I was assigned to be in charge of Venezuela and several of the other countries in the Andes for the New York Times, and I started my assignment in 2016. At that point, the Times had been in Venezuela for more than 10 years, covering kind of the rise and demise of Hugo Chavez. But with his successor, Nicolas Maduro, the government became much more strict with the media, became much more sensitive. Reporters, not just me, you know, received attacks almost on a daily basis. In my case, they put my photo on television, said that I was someone that people should not trust. You know, I was repeatedly denied access to the government. And I continued my work that year. We published stories about the collapse of the hospital system, which was the fault of the Venezuelan government, which you know, wasn't able to provide food or medicine to its people. And eventually the government decided that rather than try to discredit my work, they would push me out. So when I was returning to the country at the end of 2016, I was going through the airport, and they told me I couldn't come back. They told me my visa, even though it had many months left on it, wasn't valid anymore. And from then on, I received no responses from the government when I asked to return. You know, I had a whole life built there. I had an apartment. I was working there. The Times, as I told you, had been there for more than a decade. But just with the flip of a switch, they could deny access to one of the biggest media outlets in the U.S. to the entire country. And that's what they did when they pushed me out.
Talk about the state of press freedom in Venezuela. What do Venezuelan journalists tend to encounter in just trying to do their jobs?
Well, and this isn't just true of Venezuela. This is a lot of countries in Latin America right now. I'd say this region is much farther along, unfortunately, in the regression of press freedoms. And a lot of the trends that we're starting to see in the U.S., Latin American inequality is at a much higher level than the U.S. has seen. So you begin to see in Latin America some of the consequences of these paths, whether it's authoritarianism, inequality, freedom of the press. In the case of Venezuela, the government, and also Ecuador, the government's taken a lot of steps to try to stop journalists from doing their work. This isn't an area like Mexico where you're seeing journalists actually getting killed, but rather you're seeing ways in which the government is passing laws to regulate the media and coming out to make them look like the enemy. This all began with Hugo Chavez. It began before, but Hugo Chavez was the one that took the most, you know, kind of, you know, similar to Trump approach by going onto Twitter, by saying that the press was the enemy, by saying there was conspiracy against him personally. And that began to sink into the minds of many Venezuelans, the ones that supported Chavez, that the press was something not to be trusted. The press was not a check against government, but rather something trying to bring the government down actively. This continued on with Maduro to this, you know, sort of day where the government has passed a law which they've couched as an anti-hate law, but actually regulates the media, imposing fines, allowing the government to shut down media outlets if they publish what they consider to be hate speech. And to this government, hate speech is anything that's against the, you know, against the government or for anyone making protests against the government right now. The government's already shut down two Colombian media outlets and CNN in Spanish there, and they're refusing to let them, you know, broadcast on the airwaves right now. Mm. This trend's going to continue and get worse in the years that come.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. I wonder if I could get your thoughts, Nicholas Casey, on something that Jeff Flake of Arizona, Republican senator from Arizona, said yesterday about the president's use of the term fake news and its impact in other countries. Here is part of what Senator Flake said.
The state official in Myanmar recently said, "There is no such thing as Rohingya. It is fake news." He was referring to the persecuted ethnic group. Leaders in Singapore, a country known for restricting free speech, have promised fake news legislation in the next year. And on and on and on. This feedback loop is disgraceful, Mr. President. Not only has the past year seen an American president borrow despotic language to refer to the free press, but it seems he is now in turn inspired dictators and authoritarians with his own language. That is reprehensible. We are not in a fake news era, as Bashar Assad says. We are, rather, in an era in which the authoritarian impulse is reasserting itself to challenge free people and free societies everywhere.
That's Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake speaking yesterday on the Senate floor. I know our time is short, but Nicholas and Indira, I would love to hear from you in particular about just how much of an impact you think the president's rhetoric about fake news is actually having. Is he really generating this impact? Is he becoming the scapegoat for something that people have been feeling, that dictators have been doing, and he just kind of rearticulated in a certain way? Nicholas Casey, briefly, what do you think?
I think that countries that have authoritarian leaders right now, or ones that are aspiring to become authoritarian, are definitely looking at the U.S. The U.S. for years has been the check against this kind of trend. Now it's openly said that it is not going to be that check. So when it comes to the media, I would say in Latin America, the idea that there's conspiracy against the government by the media has long been there. But does that mean that leaders, when they see that the president is openly attacking media, especially its own media outlets like the New York Times in U.S., that if it comes to a point where they feel that they need to attack the New York Times or the Washington Post correspondent in their country, that they would be free to do that? Absolutely. I think that basically gives a nod to authoritarian leaders in any part of the world to continue attacks or to step them up.
Indira?
Look, you know, the United States has long been a beacon with our First Amendment and our freedom of the press. And, you know, we have, through the State Department, through the presidency, always complained about other countries that repress freedom of the press. And to have a president who is setting a terrible example, I mean, I have worked as a foreign correspondent in Venezuela, in Cuba, in China, in Myanmar, in a whole host of repressive countries that have cracked down on the press. And, you know, it's so disappointing to have in our own home democracy a president who is really undermining global press freedom because other leaders are turning to him. In the Philippines, Duterte, of course, Maduro, I mean, others are saying, oh, this is fake news. Syria's Bashar al-Assad has adopted the term even. So even people who don't like Donald Trump are adopting his term. And the Committee to Protect Journalists put out these press oppressor awards. And of course, naming people like Erdogan in Turkey and Putin in Russia and Xi Jinping in China.
Right.
But their overall winner for undermining global press freedom, that award went to Donald Trump. And it's really sad that we should be setting such a bad example. It troubles me and it worries me, particularly as I think of all the correspondents from those countries living there who are jailed, hundreds who are jailed and some who are killed just for doing their jobs.
I wonder very briefly, before we're out of time, I wonder, Tom and Hugo, if I could finish with you in terms of rebuilding trust. You know, as a journalist, you don't have to, I don't need you to like me. I just need you to trust me. I need you to know when I speak, you can take what I say to the bank. And if I screw it up, I will apologize as fast as possible. What do you think is the one best thing that any news organization who cares about building more trust should be doing today to make that happen? We're real low on time. But Hugo, what do you think they should do first thing?
First thing is that they should correct mistakes. They should be very swift and explicit about correcting mistakes. I think that if they were to do that, there would be rather a lot of corrections going on.
Tom?
And I would say it's transparency. We used to live in what I call the trust me era of journalism. Trust the brand. CBS News has learned. We are now in the show me era of journalism. Show me the proof in each story as to why I should believe you.
So letting people see more of the details behind the story.
How you did your work. Show your work, as your math teacher used to tell you.
That's Tom Rosensteel, Executive Director of the American Press Institute. His books include Blur, How to Know What to Believe in the Age of Information Overload, and The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. Tom, thanks for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
Hugo Gurdon is the Editorial Director of the Washington Examiner. Hugo, thank you.
Thanks very much
for having me.
Nicholas Casey, the Andes Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Nick, stay safe, and thanks for talking to us. And Indira Lakshmanan, the Chair in Journalism Ethics at the Poynter Institute and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Indira.
Thanks for having me.
Do send us your stories about what's happening inside the Interior Department. 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.